From Hook and Bullet to Policy and Science, we're here to discuss and dissect all matters of importance to Montana's rugged landscape and the people and wildlife that call it home. This is Montana Untamed. As the year comes to a close, I thought it would be good time to gather our team of outdoor writers and put a bow on it. I asked the reporters to send me some of their most important stories from 2023 so we could rehash them for folks as our last episode of the year. So with me today is Rob Chaney and Joshua Murdoch from the Missoulian newspaper, Brett French from the Billings Gazette, and Duncan Adams from the Montana Standard. All familiar voices if you've listened to the show in the past. Some of these stories will also be familiar to our habitual listeners. Topics we're going to go over today will be e-bikes in national parks, snowball ski area, the tribal bison hunt outside of Yellowstone National Park, and anacondas, urban mule deer. Welcome, guys. Let's just jump right in with you, Rob. You're reporting this year focused on the National Park Service's relationship with e-bikes, electric bikes. How's that going?
It's going to get more complicated and a lot more interesting in the near future. E-bikes really took off in the last couple of years. The technology changed pretty radically, almost as seen from month to month. They used to be sort of mini motorcycles, and now the batteries and the motors that power them are so compact. There are versions that weigh about the same as a regular Schwinn bicycle that you'd see somebody traveling around town with, and the battery's so small you can't even hardly notice that it's there. But it's a motorized transportation device. Little old ladies and little kids can go 30 miles an hour down a bike path or up the Going to the Sun Road, and that presents some interesting situations for something like national park management, where you now have a whole bunch of folks who would really like to have the ultimate scenic experience of driving over Logan Pass on a bicycle. That used to be only something that people who, you know, trained all winter on a stationary bike would be in shape enough to try to do. Mm-hmm. Now the crowd of folks who are capable of doing it is purely limited by your wallet. And that's getting, you know, the bikes are getting cheaper. They're getting more prevalent. So they're easier to rent if you don't want to make the big investment. And they are, you know, not just a national park thing. Big cities are seeing these bikes taking over commuter routes and sidewalks, and people are, you know, driving them on country roads, commuting in from the suburbs. And they're really different than the traditional sweat-powered pedaling that you usually think of when you talk about somebody who's riding a bike to work or riding a bike for fun. The national parks have got a very varied range of issues about this, from Glacier Park that has virtually no bike shoulders and really has to make accommodations for people to ride them, to places like Arches or Canyonlands National Parks down in the, you know, Utah Canyon country, where they've got tons of roads and a huge tradition of slick rock bike riding that, you know, is already sort of the horses out of the barn. So there's going to be a lot of work on this, trying to figure out a national policy or a park by park policy or what they're going to do.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, the possible problems that e-bikes pose outside of the parks from like, you know, land manager, you know, outdoor recreation management, user group standpoint. This isn't just a National Park Service situation that needs to be dealt with, right?
Exactly. You know, if somebody comes to Glacier Park or to Yellowstone Park, both of those national parks are right next to U.S. Forest Service lands that have lots of roads and Fun places to go play, places that snowmobilers, for example, have pioneered for years, now can be a summer bike riding territory. But the rules of the Forest Service are different than the rules of the National Park Service. And so if you go to the trouble of hauling your $3,000 e-bike out, and then you find out you can play with it here, but right across the river you can't, or you need a permit, or only special times you're allowed to use it here, but on this right next door area is unregulated, it's really hard for the average tourist to figure out, is it worth hauling it out here because I may not be able to do it? Or is it, take your chances and see what you can get away with, and then you cause headaches for the rangers. It's going to be just an ongoing deal.
Right. So what are some of the bigger issues that are posed by e-bikes then?
On a really more human philosophy level, it's how much do we want to enhance ourselves? The first e-bike I ran into was underneath a 70-year-old woman who was pedaling her way to the top of Lolo Pass, which is a really steep highway.
Right.
And she was doing it in honor of her pedaling the bike centennial back in 1976. She was one of the first people to ride cross country on that very famous bike project. And now, 40 years later, she was doing it again as a senior citizen with the enhancement of an e-bike. And, you want to congratulate that. You want to say, yeah, I can get older and keep doing stuff. On the other hand, the places that we really cherish in wild country, one of the reasons we cherish them is because they're so hard to get to. And you kind of need to be in prime of life to be able to do that. If it becomes a Disneyland where you can ride in on an e-bike, what's to say you can't ride in on a Segway? What's to say you can't, give yourself bionic knees when your knees have gone out? What's to say we don't need to start widening all the trails in order to accommodate all manner of other wheeled vehicles? There's a philosophical question there about where do you start limiting access because of your physical abilities. The other really fascinating question has shown up in the hunting world, and that is when they started putting these electric motors on game carts. And a game cart is not designed for a passenger, so it doesn't fall under the usual transportation issues that Forest Service and National Park Service deal with. Because it's not a passenger vehicle. So they're literally not set up to think about what happens if a 70-year-old hunter motorizes his game cart and now he can haul, scotch by the fifth into a game camp instead of the hip flask. And you just start moving that much more stuff into the backcountry for your elk camp without any real regulation or anybody having a rule to say this is okay or this is not okay. It just opens up a Pandora's box of new policy questions.
Absolutely. So why'd you pick this story?
This got probably the most reader response of any of the stories that I put out this year. And we, in the Untamed Writer Corral put up a lot of really good stuff. And by that, I mean the most response to one I wrote. Josh and Brett also got a lot of attention to their things. But it really touched a nerve with folks who are seeing this as a way to play with their outdoor world and to, make some big choices about, are you going to put a $3,000 present under the tree next week? Folks were really interested.
Right. And I think on its face value, it doesn't seem like that complex of an idea. You've got a new toy that people want to play with in the park. But when you kind of talk about the ripple effect and how much of a, paradigm shift that is, there's more than meets the eye there on that topic. Thanks, Rob. So Josh,
thank you.
You did a lot of reporting over the last year on Snowbowl, the hometown ski area just outside of Missoula, for those who are not familiar with Missoula. And it was news when they were allowed to open a couple weeks ago or earlier in December. Why was that?
Yeah, so that was, you know, whether or not they were able to open this year was followed a little bit more closely than other ski areas, or a little more closely than Snowbowl has been in past years, because it was really in question until the night before their original planned opening date, pending snow, whether the Forest Service was going to allow them to operate this year at all. The ski area, other than a little plot of private land right around the base area where the bottoms of some of the lifts are and the lodges and parking lot are located, the rest of the ski mountain is all Forest Service land in the Lolo National Forest. And this year, over the summer and into the fall, the Forest Service was conducting some additional oversight and scrutiny of lift safety and operations at Snowbowl, as well as their ski patrol operations, and making sure that the lifts were actually properly configured and maintained and up to standards, and making sure that ski patrol and lift operators were actually trained to properly respond or respond at all to safety incidents. And the supervisor of the Lolo National Forest, Carolyn Upton, said that you know, she wasn't going to give Snowbowl its annual authorization to operate for the winter season until the ski area had proven that it had completed the tasks that she had asked them to, just to substantiate that they had addressed the lift concerns and the operations concerns. And up until the evening of the day before that they originally wanted to open, they didn't have that permission yet. So it wasn't until about 8 p.m. The night before their original planned opening that they announced that they had finally gotten permission from the Forest Service to open. Unfortunately, it turned out that even though they got permission to open, they, like a lot of other ski areas around the West right now, didn't have enough snow to actually provide any skiing, which is a huge bummer for them and the community. And as of now, December 20th, that's still the case, but they're hoping to get people riding lifts and skiing as soon as they actually have enough snow to do so.
So can you embellish a little bit on what led to the Forest Service's increased oversight at the ski area?
Yeah, there was an incident last spring in which a dad and his four-year-old son loaded onto the snow park chairlift on the backside of Snowbowl ski area, where there's some easier green and blue groomer runs. And as they loaded onto the chair and the chair left the lower terminal, the little two-seat old Riblet chair was swinging back and forth. And as it approached the first upright tower of the chairlift, the chair actually swung into the vertical lift tower and the seat of the chair broke apart from the vertical hanger pole of the chair. It dumped the four-year-old 15 to 20 feet down onto the snow surface, and the dad was left clinging to the upright pole of what remained of that chair that they had been riding. And eventually he jumped down. Luckily, he and his son were, you know, largely uninjured. But even more troubling just than that incident that could happen was that there wasn't really much of a response from the lift operators or the ski patrol. The lift operators, I guess, had to be told by other people shouting at them that something had happened and they needed to stop the lift. And they loaded the dad and the son onto another chair when they got back down to the bottom, sent them back up to the top. There was no response from ski patrol, but it's unclear if anybody had informed Ski Patrol that this had happened. And the dad and son skied down to the base area on the front side and ended up talking to the ski area's management and owner. And only then did they call Ski Patrol and get somebody to respond. Meanwhile, they were still running that lift. They just pulled the rest of that broken chair off and they kept running the lift. By the time they eventually tried to notify the Forest Service, as was required, when an incident like that happens, the Forest Service had already learned from social media and other people telling them that this had occurred. And so the Forest Service ordered that that lift, Snow Park, be shut down. And they sent a Forest Service aerial ropeway engineer, which is the term for an engineer who specializes in things like gondolas and chairlifts and aerial tramways. And that engineer came out and determined that the Snow Park lift had multiple design deficiencies, largely because it had been improperly modified by Snowball. And so the halo device around Tower 1 that was supposed to prevent a swinging chair from hitting the tower had been modified out of specification and didn't perform its job of preventing a chair that swings from striking the tower. So that, you know, that happened. And then that just followed, that had come on the heels of 10 years or more of other lift incidents. This was the first one where somebody had been on a chair that broke off in the air, but there had been multiple other incidents of luckily unoccupied chairs breaking off and falling to the ground from chair lifts during regular operations with skiers on the lift. Chairs breaking off in the loading areas or unloading areas. So there had been a lot of safety concerns with chairlifts kind of mounting over many years at Snowball. And this seemed to be a bit of a final straw for the Forest Service to launch additional oversight of Snowball. So they ordered some remedies specifically for that Snow Park lift, and that was shut down for the rest of last season. The ski area operated its other lifts through the rest of last season, but then over this summer, they were ordered to bring in an outside chairlift inspector, an engineer, and look over all four of the aerial chairlifts at Snowball and address any problems that were found. They also, like I said, had to address their personnel training and response to incidents as well. And the chairlift report from that engineer came out in early September and found that there were many problems with all four chairlifts, including one that was brand new last season. And so Snowball had to fix all those things in order to get permission to open. But like I said, by early December, they did all that.
Right. And so how does this increased oversight from the Forest Service and, you know, concerns over ski lift infrastructure and operation, how does this compare to other ski areas?
That's a really interesting point here in Montana. And I'd be interested to know, you know, if we sent that engineer to every other ski area in Montana and had them look at every lift, what they would find. You know, the increased oversight at Snowball was prompted by this series of incidents. There have been one-off incidents like this at other ski areas. A few years ago, Red Lodge ski area, Red Lodge Mountain had a similar chairlift incident where people fell. I'd be interested to know, you know, if things like this were normal, where you're getting these inspections and they become public every year, what would we find at all the ski areas around the state? This one was just prompted by repeated incidents. And that's the interesting thing about Montana with chairlifts is in 1997, Montana deregulated state oversight of ski area chairlifts and other aerial tramways for passengers. Prior to 1997, there was a independent state board that employed an engineer who would go to ski areas each year, perform lift inspections. Those lift inspections would be public and they would be submitted to the Forest Service. So the Forest Service could keep track of the status of the lifts on all ski areas that operate on Forest Service land. The legislature decided in 1997 that that was a redundant regulatory mechanism. They decided they didn't need to do that. The reason being, ski areas insurance providers already require that ski areas, as a term of their insurance policy, have an engineer inspect their lifts every season before they operate. And so the state decided, why do we need to send an engineer out to inspect the lifts when the ski areas insurance companies already require them to have their engineer inspect their lifts before they operate? You know, that's redundant. Let's cut that red tape. Let's, you know, not make ski areas pay for these extra inspections. And as a state, let's not pay to conduct this additional oversight. So they got rid of the Passenger Tramway Safety Board after 1997 in Montana. But the crucial difference is that when insurance companies have their engineers come out to inspect ski areas' lifts, those reports are kept private. The ski area and the insurance companies see those reports, but they're never made public, and they never go to the U.S. Forest Service. Mm-hmm. All the ski area has to do is tell the Forest Service, yes, we did an inspection, and yes, we corrected any issues that were found. But the Forest Service in Montana doesn't really have any way to understand what issues were found, and it generally doesn't have the staffing to send its own engineer out to every ski area every year to independently verify that issues were in fact corrected. They just have to take the ski area's word for it, and the inspection reports remain private. And so that's what was different about this year's scrutiny of Snowball, is the Forest Service ordered them to do this independent engineering report separate from their insurance inspection. And that report was submitted to the Forest Service in full. And I was able to obtain it through a public records request and see what was found with all four lifts. In Montana, that hasn't really happened since before 1997. So it was unique that it was ordered for Snowball in this case.
Right. So why'd you pick this story for, you know, looking back at 2023's reporting?
Well, it's similar to what Rob said. This one certainly touched a nerve with a lot of people.
Absolutely.
From the beginning of when actually my colleague Dave Erickson wrote the original, you know, kind of fast breaking news story when the lift incident at Snow Park occurred. And then I wrote a series of follow-up stories examining the deregulation, the chairlift safety in Montana, and what the Forest Service was doing to follow up with its oversight of Snowball. And I followed kind of their progress in trying to get approval to operate this fall, and then wrote about it when they finally opened. But, you know, this was an example of our earlier reporting this past spring. I think my comprehensive look at some of the issues that have occurred at Snowball and what the Forest Service found with the Snow Park lift, along with examining the deregulation of chairlifts in Montana, that opened a lot of the public's eyes to kind of how problematic of a situation we really had going on. And that public pressure was a large factor in the Forest Service deciding to conduct their additional oversight of Snowball Ski Area in the interest of public safety over the summer and making their operations this winter contingent on meeting these certain requirements that normally wouldn't be, you know, part of allowing the ski area to open. So I think that that, you know, to me was a really good example of public service journalism where there was actually a response to it. You know, there was a positive response in this additional oversight and, you know, an agency making sure that Snowball is acting in the interest of public safety. There was certainly pushback to it, too. There were some folks in the community who felt that, it was really unfair for us to write about the issues at Snowball, and that, you know, we should, as a newspaper, be a cheerleader of local business rather than scrutinizing any safety issues or noncompliance. But, you know, I think on both sides of that, people who appreciated the reporting or people who were frustrated by it, it at least, you know, made the community a lot more aware of chairlift safety issues and how safety regulations of ski areas work in Montana, what their strengths and weak points are. And I think hopefully people can be a lot more confident in their safety and enjoyment of skiing when they go to Snowball this year, as soon as we actually get some snow.
Right, you know, and it makes you wonder if maybe it, coming up on our next legislative session in 2025, if somebody brings a bill to maybe bring back that safety board.
Because of after the story that I wrote about the deregulation of chairlift safety here, a group of Montana legislators formed a interim committee between the two legislative sessions to study exactly that, whether they should bring back the state passenger tramway safety board.
Right. Hmm. Okay, so and folks, both of those topics that we've previously discussed, we've done longer full-length episodes on those topics. So I would encourage you to go back and listen to those if you want more of the nitty-gritty detail on those. Another such topic is what Brett has brought to the table here. Last winter saw the most bison ever killed by tribal hunters outside of Yellowstone National Park, obviously in modern times. What's happened since then, Brett?
Yeah, Tom, since then, the Park Service came out with its updated bison management plan, which updated population objectives for bison in the park. And that caused quite a stir with the state of Montana, which wants to see Yellowstone National Park keep bison numbers low so they don't migrate out of the park and into Montana due to concerns about brucellosis transmission from bison to cattle. There was also a big tribal meeting, a bunch of the treaty rights holders who hunt bison outside of Yellowstone all got together in Idaho to talk about co-managing bison, and at this fall's interagency bison meeting, they set targets for what they'd like to see number of bison removed, and that prompted some discussion about the bison plan. The state suggesting that Yellowstone's not doing enough to keep bison numbers low. And the Park Service basically saying, well, what we do inside the park is our business, and we're not going to do necessarily what you want. So that friction has extended into this year and into this hunting season, I guess, too. We'll see.
Now, are hunters predicted to be as successful this year?
Yeah, last year was really unusual in the amount of snowfall and cold that Yellowstone experienced, creating one of the largest migrations in about a decade outside of the park. Most of those bison come into that Gardner Basin just to the north of the park, and so it was a really big movement of bison, which enabled the hunters, tribal hunters, to kill more than 1,000 bison. Population dropped from over 6,000 bison inside the park last year to an estimate of around 4,800 this summer. So a pretty big drop in bison numbers. So it's not predicted that they'll be as successful this year, but it's very weather dependent.
Right, right. So and your most recent story, which was a part of a big project we all worked on, the ESA at 50 project, if you've been listening, the last couple episodes of this show have been tied to that project. I encourage you all to go on and look at all the pieces of that. But anyway, The most recent story you wrote for that project also focuses on bison, and it detailed how groups are seeking endangered species protection for the critter. Tell listeners why they might be seeking this federal protection for the Yellowstone bison.
Yeah, so one of the comparisons I think people can kind of relate to maybe is that the bison in Yellowstone have been compared to hatchery fish, where they're kept within a certain area. That's one of the biggest complaints of the groups who have filed a lawsuit, that bison are being restricted on where they can wander outside the park. This is a concern as the climate changes and animals need to seek different habitats where they can thrive. There's also this concern about a loss of genetic memory for migration, especially with bison being killed or slaughtered by the Park Service, or picked out from by the Park Service to be transferred to tribes. And there's also the tribal ability to harvest is a concern. They suggest that, you know, that's being restricted by this control by the state, not allowing more bison to wander outside the park. They're claiming treaty rights should succeed or hold priority over the state's rights to control bison inside the state.
Mm-hmm. So, Brett, why this topic to pick?
It really touched a lot of nerves with readers. Interestingly, it also pits some conservation groups against each other who have backed tribal hunting as a way to control populations. There's other conservation groups who don't want to see this large of a harvest, want to see one of the billboards that went up was, is it a harvest, a hunt, or a slaughter? That kind of points out some of those concerns that are being raised. And it's also the national mammal, the bison is. And so there's a lot of concern about how it's managed. And Yellowstone, obviously, being such an iconic park, always drives a lot of interest about what's going on there with wildlife. And also the livestock interest, you know, and the control that still exerts in Montana regarding wildlife management. No other species in Montana is managed like the bison is. So hits on a lot of different issues.
So, Duncan, you wrote about the mule deer that roam the city of Anaconda basically with impunity. And an FWP wildlife biologist raised concerns about the deer nearly 3 years ago. Will you tell us about what's going on?
Sure. That was Julie Gala, who was a wildlife biologist for FWP in Upper Clark Fork. And she was concerned for several reasons that there was this population of essentially habituated mule deer in Anaconda. She was worried about the deer because they were eating things that weren't part of their normal diet, like corn and bird seed and all sorts of other things. She was worried that was going to affect them, their nutrition in a big way. And she said, raising fawns on offerings of corn is synonymous with raising children on ice cream. So she had that concern, but she had a more ominous worry. She said that the complacent deer in town could draw a mountain lion in town, and the outcome of that could be tragic.
All right.
And so that actually happened in May of 2021. And a resident got a photo of the lion. It was just sort of sauntering through an alleyway. It had killed a mule deer. It had partially consumed it. It had cached it and did not come back to eat more of the deer because the community was waking up. at that point. And the FWP confirmed that it was a mountain lion kill. Now, that sort of thing is rare, but it's a possibility. And there's a pretty healthy population of lions around Anaconda. So
And now, you know, officials of Anaconda believe that there's like a division among residents that maybe are split 50-50 about these deer, you know, that browse the yards, share the sidewalks, dart into traffic. What are these positions of the two camps?
Yeah, I think it probably is about 50-50 from talking to people. There are those who just enjoy having this close-up view of a, you know, usually wild animal to observe their behavior. You know, they could be kind of cute. And some of them are having their fawns in the city. So they enjoy just that close-up observation. And so there's that whole camp, you know, and some of those people are feeding the deer, which which is illegal, but it's been happening. So, and then there are the other camp who see the deer as pests. They come in your garden, they eat your garden, they eat your flowers, they scatter their droppings all over town. They're a hazard to people, to vehicles crossing streets. You know, in some communities, they've been aggressive towards dogs and children. I don't know that that's happened in Anaconda. And so, you know, I watched them during Halloween this year consuming pumpkins all over town. They were happily consuming pumpkins.
Oh, yeah, I bet.
And that was kind of funny. I saw three deer standing on a woman's front porch eating her pumpkin.
So you mentioned other – oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
You mentioned other Montana communities that, you know, are kind of have the same issue. And they've adopted wildlife management plans, right?
Yes. And I'm told about a dozen communities have wildlife management plans. And I worked in Libby for the Western News when they were developing a plan because they had these nuisance white-tailed deer in the city. And a very high percentage of them had CWD or chronic wasting disease.
Right.
So, and they eventually developed a plan to trap and kill deer. And the deer that weren't positive for CWD, they donated to the food bank. I know Helena has a program.
Yep, absolutely.
Has a plan. And just more recently, the town of Phillipsburg and the city of Geraldine drafted plans. You know, in Phillipsburg, they wanted to cull deer to, you know, improve human safety and keep property from being damaged. And they also didn't want predators coming into town.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, mule deer have lived around Anaconda since the beginning of time. I feel like, you know, the mule deer population in Anaconda, I mean, I'm sure that it's bothered these folks in the past. And why is there this momentum to consider action today?
I think in the past there has been this 50-50 split. So that's made county commissioners and game wardens and law enforcement reluctant to enforce any ordinances about feeding deer, etc., and to do anything about the deer. But, you know, this fall, a deer that was killed by a hunter, a mule deer buck that was killed by a hunter in Hunting District 213, which is right near Anaconda, was determined to have CWD. So yeah. that really upped the ante. And Kirsten Yeager, who's a wildlife biologist for FWP, said the densities of deer in Anaconda could facilitate the spread of CWD. And I guess, you know, that just makes sense. If it spreads to deer and elk and moose, then you start to think about the economic impacts of losing some outdoor recreation. And Anaconda has is evolving from the smelter down to an outdoor recreation town. So all of that has driven the county commission to move forward, to get off the dime, so to speak.
Okay, so, you know, I gather from the story that the county commissioners in Anaconda Deer Lodge County are considering an ordinance to create a task force that would study the urban wildlife problems and draft recommendations for this plan. What would this task force duties be then?
Well, they would consult with wildlife officials, biologists. They would have a wildlife person, knowledgeable wildlife, on their committee. And I think that's going to be Chris Marchand of Anaconda, who has a long history with the Montana Wildlife Federation and other organizations. They'll talk to the community and get their feedback. They'll look at other wildlife management plans around Montana and ultimately come up with a recommendation. Do we need a plan? And then B, if so, what are we going to do? How are we going to cull these deer? Communities have adopted any number of strategies for culling their deer. So that's kind of right. What the task force will be looking at in the months ahead.
Okay. And hey, why did you pick this Anaconda mule deer story as one of your favorites for the year?
Well, partly because it's ongoing. And, you know, I don't live in Anaconda, but I'm in Anaconda regularly. And you can't miss this issue. It's like right in front of you. You know, that one mountain lion that we know of has come into town. The next one might come into town and kill somebody's pets or worse. So I think it's something that needs attention, and the county commission is trying to do that.
All right, guys. Well, hey, thanks for coming on. I guess here's cheers to 2023 and looking towards 2024. Thanks, guys.
That's right, Tom.
Yeah, thanks, Tom, for all your hard work on this. I know it's been a lot on your plate.
Yeah, no problem at all. It's fun tapping in with you guys every week and going over what we're publishing.
The ESA at 50 has been a statewide project that is also getting a lot of national attention. Montana was the locus for a whole bunch of the biggest decisions on Endangered Species Act management. Brett and Josh and our colleague Duncan Adams over at the Montana Standard really went after some of those big questions. We'll be talking about more of those in the coming year. And we got a whole lot of outdoor stuff to talk about in 2024 coming at us.
Absolutely. No, just another plug there for that ESA project. I really encourage everybody to go on and look at all the work we did compiling what we think are kind of answers to some of these big, heady questions around the Endangered Species Act. Again, thanks, guys. Here's to next year.
Next year.
Mm-hmm.
Coming up quick.
Montana Untamed is a podcast from the newsrooms of Lee Enterprises Montana newspapers. Visit any of our websites or subscribe wherever podcasts are found.